constitutional development when it was called then in 1994, but prior to that he also was serving in the negotiations team that dealt first with the interim constitution and approved it, and I remember some stage he was dealing with the transitional local government at that stage. So he was humble enough to allow himself to come and share with the committee. Also want to welcome members of the media who are present here with us. Members, we've received the apologies that I have, that I've received, is Ms. Masego and Ms. Mabila Ngwenya, who has a death in the family. Are there other apologies, Secretary? Yes, Mr. Mayor.
Thanks, Chair. Honorable Rosina Semenya will join us later. She's still held up in traffic. Or Rosina Semenya.
Thank you. We take note of those. Members, the agenda is before you. It was circulated electronic as well as the minutes. Can I get the mover for the adoption of the agenda? Honorable Nguni.
Good morning, Chair. Thank you for welcoming us. I want to move, but if you, with your indulgence, Chair, just make an indication that as members are sponsored by parties, probably the ANC will get back to the committee to confirm the availability going further of Honorable Nono Maloyi. So it's not necessarily an apology, it's just for noting. With that, Chair, I move for the noting or acceptance of the apologies as tabled. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I noted the apology by default of Nono Maloyi. The other matters that the party must deal with, they would advise us. But as of today's meeting, we note his apology. There's been a mover for the adoption of the agenda. Is there any seconder? Honorable Smith, second. Thank you very much. We've got minutes that have been circulated, and I take it that they've been read by members. Are there any corrections that members would like to make on the minutes of our previous meeting? Honorable Mwabe.
Thank you, Chair. Greetings to colleagues and the presenters and the former minister. Chair, I assume it's the minutes of the 21st of February.
Yes.
I have. The very correction I want to make is the urgent one before I even go on the members of committees. Yes, I'm from the National Freedom Party, but I appear as Ms. S. Ngwa. That's a serious concern, Chair.
You really do cute that members.
That one I contest, yeah, from those who compiled the minutes.
Thank you very much. That correction will be made. Any other correction? Well, there are no additional corrections that I'm receiving from members.
Chair, sorry.
Yes, Honorable.
I'm not sure, but probably it's correct to use the same template. Maybe the template used by the committee secretary was the one of the first meeting, but am I right that this meeting is the one which was opened by the chair?
No, there's been a mistake with the secretary.
Yeah.
Next to me has already noted on page 2, instead of the committee secretary, is the chairperson opened the meeting. With those corrections, can I get the mover for the adoption of the minutes? Honorable Maila moves, seconded by Honorable Ngabe, who seconds. Are there any matters arising other than those that are on the agenda? Just to remind members that we had indicated that today we will get the presentation from the legal office on the court case, AfriForum court case, what the order and its implications are. We won't deliberate on that. We will take that towards the end in terms of deliberations, but presentations will be made. We will then have a summary of the Constitutional Review Committee report, which will be done by the content advisor to this committee, and then thereafter we'll start with our presentation from experts. You'd recall that members indicated in the last meeting that we need to add a few more items, because in the last proposal on the program we only had two issues. So I take it that you would agree with us. Just want to inform the meeting that Honorable Bettenbach did indicate that she would leave by 12:30. The challenge of flights in the province where she comes from, they are very limited, so that will have an impact. I also want Honorable Mguni, you might be going the same distance, but your obligations may not be the same. Just to indicate that we did consult with the committee section with respect to the meeting dates. As of now, a majority of committees are sitting, and it impacts on a majority of the members seated here. So the only day that is still available is Friday. So I just want to indicate to members that what you had asked us to do, we did. So can we now go, since no one is raising any matter, can we move to our first presentation on the presentation of the AfriForum case versus Parliament?
Good morning, Chair President, honorable members, and thank you. My name is Nathi Mjengwane from Parliamentary Legal Services. As noted, as you noted by yourself, Chairperson, I'll be making a quick presentation on the AfriForum matter. But just before I get to the presentation, Chair, with your permission, I'd like to just sketch a brief background. I know later in the program, the committee will get the report of the CRC, which will sketch the process that took place there. So Chairperson, there were House resolutions in the National Assembly and the NCOP on the matter of Section 25, as known to members, which led to the process of looking into Section 25 ensuing at the CRC. The CRC determined its internal processes on how it was to go about doing its work and agreed on a truncated time period. And this contested with the significant public interest on the matter before the CRC at the time. What immediately became clear to the committee management chairperson was that there were capacity constraints to deal with the amount of work at committee, and a decision was then taken that a service provider would have to be appointed to assist or to bolster the capacity of the committee to do its work. And a service provider was appointed. During this entire process, Chairperson, the service provider worked under the direction and management of Parliament. The CRC concluded its work and the report was adopted at the committee. Just after the adoption of the committee, Chairperson then entered this process. Papers were served before Parliament on an urgent basis by AfriForum. AfriForum is a non profit consortium, which is known to members, and the other parties or the respondents in the matter was the chairperson of the, should have been chairpersons, but they only cited one chairperson of the Joint Constitutional Joint Constitutional Review Committee of Parliament. The speaker was the second respondent, speaker of the National Assembly, and the third respondent was the chairperson of the National Council of Provinces. So the matter of the AfriForum chairperson was divided into two parts, Part A and Part B. Part A dealt with an urgent interdict. In that interdict, AfriForum sought to suspend the decision of the CRC, which was taken on the 15th of November 2018, and possibly review it. So that was the first part. They wanted to restrain or ask the court to restrain the CRC report from being sent to the National Assembly and the NA and the NCOP for processing. And part B of the forum application dealt with the declarator, or they wanted the court to declare that the decision of the CRC to adopt the report was unconstitutional and therefore had to be declared as constitutionally invalid in terms of Section 172(1) of the Constitution. And they also wanted that the court direct that if what they sought in Part B, the declarator, could not be granted, that the court must make any just and equitable decision to address their concern. The grounds on which AfriForum based its challenge, Chairperson, was firstly that the service provider, which I mentioned in my opening remarks, was in fact a third party, and that it is that third party that did most of the work or did the work for the CRC when that work should have been done by the CRC. And they said that the report had been prepared by the service provider on behalf of the CRC, and that the service provider had no credentials to do the job, and AfriForum also criticized the appointment process of the service provider. And secondly, they wanted to nullify and exclude, they alleged that there had been submissions to the committee which were nullified and excluded, and that this constituted a breach of the constitutional obligation to facilitate adequate public involvement. On this basis, the AfriForum wanted the report of the service provider, which they claimed was flawed, to be set aside, and that the report itself be declared to be irregular. In response, Chairperson, Parliament argued in the following way. Parliament said that the right to public participation had been given effect to by the committee, and that the CRC report was neither binding nor determinative, in that it was not final. It still had to be sent to the two respective houses for further deliberation and resolution, and that no legal consequences resulted from the report of the CRC. Parliament further argued that the judicial intervention which was sought by the AfriForum was in fact premature. In line with the principle of separation of powers, this matter was Parliament was seized with this matter, and that Parliament must be given space to do its work, and that the High Court had no jurisdiction in the matter because the AfriForum had prefaced its challenge on Section 59 of the Constitution, which sets out the constitutional obligation on Parliament to facilitate public involvement. Our members will remember that where Parliament is said to have failed to discharge a constitutional obligation, that matter is a matter to be solely heard by the Constitutional Court. And that Parliament also argued, as I presented earlier, that the service provider's involvement stemmed from an appointment to assist Parliament and not to take the role of Parliament. The Court's decision in this regard, Chairperson, came in the following. Firstly, the court refused to grant the order as requested by the AfriForum. But in doing so, the court did not write down a judgment. It gave a verbalized order in which it dismissed Part A of the forum, which is the interdict application. And that it said the urgent interdict to prevent the adoption of the CRC report would be dismissed. However, Part B of the application, which was the review of the process that took place before the CRC, would still be heard by the court. However, parties, being the AfriForum lawyers and those of Parliament, must agree or take instructions from their clients and agree on a timetable to handle the Part B of that application, which is a review application. Currently, Chairperson, what is happening is that Parliament has provided the entire record of the CRC to the lawyers of the AfriForum, for it to go through the record so that it can further prosecute its review application in Part B if it so feels. What is common cause is that since this decision of the High Court on the interdict, the National Assembly adopted the CRC report, which led to the formation of this committee, and that parties are currently in the process of agreeing on a timetable to further handle the review application, which is part B of the AfriForum application. On the way forward, Chairperson, as mentioned, the NA has resolved on this matter and this committee has been formed to do its work, and that there is a view from our senior counsel who represented us in the at the High Court in the AfriForum matter, that this matter is actually moot on the basis of it, on the basis that the Assembly has already resolved on the matter, and therefore the review application that the AfriForum sought has now become obsolete. Of course, this view is preliminary and has not been advanced, as the matter is still very much alive before the High Court and pending the agreement on the timetable by parties. And the AfriForum decision has no bearing or impediment on the work of this committee. In this regard, Chairperson, I'd like to speak slightly to the rule of sub judice, as members will remember, that this rule is a common law rule, pre-constitutional rule, relating to, in effect, the fact that if a matter is under judgment or before consideration by a court, no other platform should hear the same matter. I've noted there, Chairperson, the Media Television Supreme Court of Appeal judgment, which considered, recent judgment, which considered the rule of sub judice and its application under the constitutional order. That judgment, Chairperson, considerably clipped the wings of the sub judice rule. It set a legal standard that must be considered now when the matter of sub judice comes up, and that standard is that there must be a demonstrable and substantial prejudice to the administration of justice on the other platform that's hearing the matter. That must be the effect that hearing, such as this one now, would have on the judicial matters to be considered in the review application. And in our future, in the work that's taking place before this committee at the moment has no bearing, certainly not on the basis of the statute K rule, to the application that's currently before the High Court. And this is the end of our presentation in this matter. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, sir, for giving us the briefing. Members would recall that the reason for us to have this presentation made was to enable members to understand what was the essence of the application and how the matters was resolved, given that indeed the case was in two parts. So we just thought it's important for us to be appraised, so that if there are any considerations that we would want to make as a committee, we can just to advise ourselves on how to go forward. Obviously, there isn't much in respect of the second part, because it's still a matter that has to be deliberated upon. I'm not sure whether members would want to ask questions for clarity. As we said, that the discussion on how we move forward will be taken later. But if there are any questions for clarity, we can allow members to ask. Honourable Mngabe?
Chair, actually, it's not a question, but as someone was there in the entire process, it's just to confirm that the report is a true reflection of what happened. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Mayela?
Thanks very much, Chair. I echo what was said by Honourable Mayela.
Thank you very much, and thanks to the presenter for your presentation. Who is going to be taking us through the summary? Over to you. We're dealing with the summary of the CRC report. Just to refresh our minds, what was the essence of that report? You can take the platform.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, everyone. My name is Shoaib Dinesen. I'm the content advisor assisting the committee. I assume that members do have a hard copy in front of them, because I'm going to do a hard copy rather than an electronic presentation. Is that better, Chair? I'm very scared of these things, Chair. Chairperson, as you correctly stated, we are doing the summary to refresh members' memories of the arguments that are captured in the report of the Joint Constitutional Review Committee. So I will not read every single sentence, but I will basically try and just highlight the arguments so that we are brief enough for the other input. We already stated the objective, so I will go through some of the agreements, the key agreements that the joint CRC report listed, and they are the following. It's an agreement that inequality and skewed land ownership continues to exist. The dispossessed in this process of the CRC expressed the view that very little was done, was being done to redress the skewed land ownership patterns. The security of tenure for farm owners, for farm workers, farm tenants, and those residing on communal land held in trust must be assured. Corruption and insufficient budget for the land reform process and a lack of capacity within the state are some of the stumbling blocks that stymied land reform thus far. The state should formulate a clear strategy for land redistribution to address the injustice of the past that was inflicted on the majority of South Africans. And the last one on page 2 at the top, while the Constitution implicitly states expropriation of land without compensation as a legitimate option for land reform, it needs to be explicitly stated. Now, policymaking is about contestation. The court case that was just dealt with is an example of that. And the crafting, it's also about the crafting of sufficient consensus from divergent views to make implementable legislation. It was stressed earlier on from members who were part of the CRC process that process afforded South Africans fair opportunity to make representation on the review of Section 25 to Parliament in a language of their choice. The divergent views that was expressed in the joint CRC process provide useful indicators to precisely which subsections and aspects of Section 25 may require this committee's focused attention. It must be noted that, we need to scratch the as there, the NA and NCOP took a resolution to establish this ad hoc committee to process the amendment of Section 25 to ensure expropriation without compensation. So rather than reigniting the argument for or against, the part that follows lists divergent views within the argument for the amendment to ensure expropriation without compensation. Now, the first view stated that the whole of Section 25 is an impediment to the expropriation of land without compensation. In fact, it stated that it was an impediment to land reform, and that section, subsection 1 and 2, 1 to 3, is the reason, implicitly then, for the failure of land reform. I'll move to the second one on the top of page 3. Another view stated that under certain prescribed circumstances, the Constitution in its current form already allowed for expropriation of land with zero compensation, therefore below the market rate, etc. Along this argument, Section 25 did not guarantee property rights in absolute terms. The argument referred to section sub 2 of Section 25A, which states that property may be expropriated only in terms of law of general application for public purpose or in the public interest, defined to include the nation's commitment to land reform. This argument further held that the Constitution did not prescribe the willing buyer, willing seller approach. The argument was that sub 3 of Section 25 guided that the amount of compensation must be just and equitable, and that compensation had to reflect an equitable balance between the public interest and the interests of those affected. Sub 5 of Section 25 refers to the need for, and here we quote, legislative and other measures to ensure conditions which enable citizens to gain access to land on an equitable basis. In addition, sub 8 continued to state that, and here we quote, no provision of this section may impede the state from taking legislative and other measures to achieve land, water, and related reform in order to redress the results of past racial discrimination, close quote. Provided that any departure from the provisions of this section is in accordance with the provisions of Section 36(1), which is the Limitation of Rights Clause of the Bill of Rights. The view continued and stressed that the Bill of Rights was also limited in only in terms of law of general application. Proponents of the view thought that the solution sketched in the argument was, rather than amending Section 25, Parliament had to repeal the current Expropriation Act, which although it predates the Constitution, is still the one that's used to expropriate, 63 of 75. Parliament had to process the draft expropriation bill, which has been reintroduced in December 2018, and it's open for public comment at the moment, without delay so that it was in line with Section 25, so that expropriation, in other words, is in line with Section 25 of the Constitution, and so that it clarified terms and conditions under which land could be expropriated without compensation in the public interest. On page 5, another point that was made in relation to subsection 6 of Section 25, which provides for traditional communities to restitution of property. Sub 6 states that a person or community whose tenure of land is legally insecure as a result of past racially discriminatory laws or practices is entitled to the extent provided by an Act of Parliament, either to tenure, which is legally secure, or to comparable redress. The argument was that 13% of communal land falls under the custodianship of traditional leaders and must not be expropriated. There is a piece of legislation in the mandate of the Department of Rural Development and Land Reform to that effect. The CRC made a clear point that security of tenure had to be strengthened to ensure the protection of people living on farms, labor tenants, as well as women and children, who were often negatively affected and suffer the worst when farms were sold or the main breadwinner became incapacitated to work. The argument was for altering the current land tenure regime to address the slow pace of land reform and high costs of land redistribution. The last point we include in the summary is it's important to recall what follows, that the CRC identified as impediments to the current land reform regime. And the importance of this is that it came through a process of the general public stating these. The first was policy uncertainty. The next, failure to implement current provisions of the Constitution and land reform laws. A land audit that was felt was biased and not transparent, paying for stolen land, and a lack of political will. Now, as this is a summary, Honourable Chair and members, we are not claiming that we included everything that is in the CRC. Of course, the summary cannot. But we hope that we captured the main arguments and some of the subsections that may require further attention in the work of this committee. The last page contains the resolution that brought this committee to life. Thank you, Honourable Chair.
Thank you very much, Advisor, for that summary. It is indeed not the detailed report, because the detailed report of the committee is there for all to see. And as we indicated last week, we are not an extension of the CRC. The CRC's mandate came to an end when it reported to the House. However, we thought, as the committee who's entrusted to do the amendment of Section 25 arising out of that process, it's important for us just to refresh our minds, understand what were the arguments, what were the issues that emerged in the various from the various constituencies as they made their presentations to the committee. So I will just take maybe if there's any questions for clarity, but as stated even by the content advisor, this is not conclusive report, it's just a summary. Honourable Maila.
Thank you very much. I don't have a question for clarity. Generally, I agree with the summary as how we as captured, but I would just like to make one alteration on page 1, where it says, the third paragraph, where it says the joint CRC report lists the following key agreements. I wanted the word agreements to be changed to observations.
Thank you very much for that noting. Honourable Smith? Thank you very much for that noting, and I don't see any hand, but I just want to make an observation. Yesterday I spoke in a particular forum on the land matters, and I did indeed indicate that as a chairperson of the committee, I will not speak about this process because that was not my mandate. However, I'll speak on land reform in general. And what I said, which I thought is important for us to keep at the back of our minds, is what does land reform in a number of countries really represent? Because it's not like it's South Africa that has started undertaking land reform, or that land reform will come to an end at any stage. There will always be land restructuring in any society. So the way I put it was that actually land reform in a number of countries is about dealing with the mischief or the challenge that a society faces at a particular given time, where it would then look and say, what is the problem in our jurisdiction? And I actually took that meeting through the current debates that are happening in some of the OECD countries as we speak. Germany in the coming months will be undertaking a referendum. The mischief they are trying to deal with is the mischief of housing, adequacy of housing in Berlin. So they are looking at whether or not they shouldn't intervene on the extent of ownership that some landlords have in the city of Berlin so that they can take some of those 200,000 houses of your bigger landlords and actually turn those into social housing. If you look at Britain, UK, apart from the challenge of Brexit, is the challenge of housing. And there the issue is about the affordability of housing in the city of London, particularly for your new entrants, younger people who are just starting families, the unaffordability of housing. And there's a paper for members that maybe in their spare time they can Google and read by the former president, Tony Blair, is grappling with the same issue. And also political parties in Britain are also saying we need to address this problem. So maybe we might need to tinker with our land laws to look at how they provide for this challenge that we're facing. In the US, we know each and every state, time and again, they would look at a particular problem that they face, either for development of industries or for development of public infrastructure or even for dealing with, social issues such as housing. They will then say, let's look at you know, what is our standing of our land issue. So these are the reforms that will take place at any given time in any society. So what the content advisor in the summary that he was making, I actually said to myself, as a South African mischief that we are dealing with, policy uncertainty, pressure and frustration of the slow pace of delivery, the continuing informal tenure rights for rural people, farm dwellers and, you know, labor tenants. So this is our own mischief. And this committee really, beyond the CRC, its mandate is to address this mischief and look to what extent this mischief can be dealt with in the Constitution and as Public Works is doing with the Expropriation Act in the general law of application. As we know that the Land Affairs or Rural Development Ministry was also trying to look at an omnibus land redistribution bill which would also deal with the same mischief on land. So I just thought it was very interesting because I said maybe as South African we should also not fear this issue about land restructuring. Because whatever you do today, in future when our society is faced with some of the challenges, they might have to come back, maybe not in the Constitution, they might come back on any law of general application and say, what do we do with the mischief? For those of you who attended the workshop in the beginning of the year convened by PLAS together with the University of Fort Hare and University of Western Cape, one of the issues that emerged in that discourse was part of the challenges in the institutional framework of government that has actually had an impact, as the CRC process also identified that part of the institutional frameworks that we have as government has not assisted in dealing with this mischief of land in our country. So as we listen to our experts, as we reflect on other documentation that we may come upon, we will have to make a proposal to the National Assembly how we think it must deal with this mischief that we have. We now move to the next step where we take our expert presenters. We have given them all one question that they must address. Mr. Vali Musa.
They've upgraded the system since I was here. thank you very much, Madam Chair. Can I just at the outset warn you that I have a little bit of a cough, so if you find me coughing, don't get nervous. It's just happening. Yeah. Thank you very much for inviting me to this committee. And perhaps I should just say that I had spent 9 years of my career working more or less full-time on the South African Constitution. Initially, the drafting of the Constitution and then the implementation of the Constitution. And the presentation I would like to make goes beyond a legal presentation. It's a constitution-making presentation that I would like to make. Because my expertise really and my experience has been in the South African constitution-making process. And this committee has the enormous and very weighty responsibility with the mandate that's been given by Parliament to play a role in the constitution making of the future. And that's a weighty role because you don't make a constitution every day. We made this constitution more or less about 25 years ago. And it's the first time in 25 years, after a whole generation, that South African society is considering amending the Bill of Rights. Am I right? It is the first time. And it shows that the Bill of Rights is extremely robust and durable. Parliament did not consider every 2 or 3 years, let's change the Bill of Rights. And so when you involve yourself in the making of the Constitution, the first thing this committee will have to bear in mind is that you're probably going to make something that should have a lifespan of 25 years, maybe 50 years, maybe longer. So that's the sort of frame of mind. It's not easy to do that, but it's a frame of mind that the committee has to place itself in when making the Constitution. It's not an easy thing to do when you're dealing with an important question like the land question, because it's not an unemotional question. And it's also not an easy thing to do when political parties are in the throes of an election campaign. It's not an easy thing. It's easier to think what will get us the votes in May than to think about what will life look like in 25 years from now, when I can assure you most of you won't be in Parliament. Like me, look, I'm not in Parliament now. So that's the first thing I'd like. I think that the weight of what is being done, I think, is very important for the committee to do that. I must say at the outset that when I was invited by the committee, I took another look at the report of the Constitutional Review Committee, and I took another look at what Parliament said to this committee. On the 6th of December 2018, Parliament, I got the minutes of the proceedings of the National Assembly to see exactly what it said. And I must say to you that I think the general public out there don't really know what Parliament is doing. Because if it knew what Parliament is doing, they would have the same attitude that you, Chairperson, has in your introductory remarks just now about this is an important debate that's happening all around the world. The sky is not going to fall. And it's important for us to have the debate because the land question in many countries, including in South Africa, is unresolved. And it's the duty of Parliament to continually to look at how to resolve the land question. The other important thing, before I talk about the content of this matter, I should just talk about, because of the weightiness of it, I want to talk about the legitimacy of the Constitution. When the Constitution was drafted over a 6-year period, which I was involved in, as I said, on a daily basis, from 1990 to 1994, I was Secretary of the ANC's Negotiations Commission as a member of the National Executive Committee, and I woke up every day to go and negotiate with the enemy. That's what my job was. So I can give you the history of every line in the Constitution. And from 94 to 96, when we adopted the final Constitution, I led the ANC's delegation in the Constitutional Assembly. And so the 300 or so words in section 25 of the Constitution is something I know very well, and I can tell you about, thank you very much, I can tell you about all of the words in there. But the most important thing to talk about here is the legitimacy of the Constitution. When we put the Constitution to the vote in the Constitutional Assembly, and it needed a certain special majorities and those sorts of things, most of the political parties in Parliament were not happy with the Constitution, actually. The ANC, of course, said it was very happy with the Constitution and proposed it and voted in favour of it. The others voted in favour of it. They said, we're not too happy, but we're going to support it. And if you look at the Constitution today, it is the most legitimate institution, if I can call it that, in South African society. And when the marketing and branding experts in the private sector continually they do surveys as to what is the most acceptable and popular brand in South Africa? Is it Coca-Cola? Is it the name of the president? Is it this or is it that? And the Constitution always comes up tops as the most trusted brand in South Africa. And so it has enormous legitimacy, enormous legitimacy. When the country had a problem in the past few years with some of our elected leaders having gone rogue, people resorted to the Constitution. Opposition parties in Parliament said, you're violating the Constitution. Media, members of the public. So it was it's extremely legitimate and trusted. And it's trusted not just because it's a good constitution, and not just because it is superior in many ways. When it was adopted in 1966, it was the most modern and probably the most enlightened constitution the world had seen up to then. Yes.
1996.
Oh. 1996. So the content is superior, but it's not legitimate only for that reason. It's legitimate because of the process through which it was adopted. An enormous energy was put into following the right process, because you could have a group of very clever experts sitting in a room drafting a very clever constitution and a very right constitution. It may not have the legitimacy if society does not own it. And I think our constitution is one which is owned by society. People know where it came from. A decision was taken very early on in the constitutional negotiations, before the multi-party talks. We had an institution called CODESA, which was closed down for various reasons and replaced by the multi-party negotiating forum. Already at CODESA, a decision was taken that a political party, when it sends its negotiating team, it can't be made up only of men. Now, I must tell you, in those days, it was a very radical decision to take, to say that, why are you only men here? And the political parties in the negotiating teams had to scramble around to find women in their ranks, you know, to be part of the negotiating team. Because it was said, you can't have a constitution that's made by men. How is it going to be trusted by everybody as such? I'm just giving you one example, you know, why. The other was that the negotiating room would be open to the public to observe. And that was another radical decision. People thought, oh, well, we're going to be overwhelmed. Millions of people will come into the room. How will you even think? But after a few weeks, it became like this. A few interested people came, a few interested journalists, one or two academics, law professors came to see what was happening. And it was the idea was, you should not draft a constitution above the heads of or behind the backs of the people. And it's another important thing. And so the process is important. The reason, Chairperson, I'm emphasizing on this is I started wondering, what is the process for amending the Bill of Rights? Actually, perhaps this committee needs to give consideration to the process, because the Constitution says, remember, it's not illegal or illegitimate to amend the Bill of Rights. So let's get that out of the way. Because if it was illegitimate to do that, the Constitution would have said, you may never amend the Bill of Rights. But in fact, what the Constitution says, if you do want to amend the Bill of Rights, you have to follow the following procedure. By that is meant, you have to follow the following, you have to fulfill the following minimum requirements. These are minimum requirements that have to be followed. A certain special majority, published for 30 days, do this, that, whatever, which the legal experts of the committee will make sure that all of that gets done. But those are minimum requirements of the Constitution. You are not going to, your mandate is to amend the Constitution, so that's why I'm not talking about the desirability or otherwise of amending the Constitution. I'm just assuming that's your mandate and that's what you're going to. When you amend the Constitution, you're not taking a decision that could be put in the same class as increasing by 5% the tax on a pack of 20 cigarettes. You know, you're doing something much more weighty than that. And so the mere procedure, the minimum procedure, probably is not in itself sufficient. I think that you have to think about, you have to invent the process to amend the Bill of Rights, which part of it is the legal and procedural thing, the other part of it is the nation-building part of it, and the legitimacy part of it. When you come out on the other side of this amendment, people should embrace it for the next 25 years and say, we love it. That's what they should do. And so that is not a, the lawyers are not going to be able to tell you how to do that, and the legal advisors of the committee. That's for you as leaders of the public to give some thought to. I would suggest you give yourself a little bit of time to think about what that process could be. I'm not making specific recommendations in this regard, but I'm saying my firm recommendation is that you need to invent the process and say this is the process that we're going to have because we want it to be legitimate. The other important reason why you need to give thought to the process is you wouldn't want the Bill of Rights, now that the Bill of Rights is going to be changed for the first time after 25 years, you wouldn't want every 3 or 4 years the Bill of Rights to be changed. You want there to be a long gestation period, and you've started off very well, Parliament, by having the public hearings. I think that was great, because it's not being taken that lightly, by having the CRC with all of its deliberations. So the process up to now cannot be faulted, as far as I'm concerned. But you don't want it to be done very lightly, so you are now going to set a precedent for how to amend the Bill of Rights. It's not a legal thing, but it's precedent nonetheless. And set the right precedent, so that if you get all over the world today, we have populist governments doing all sorts of strange things and taking populist decisions. In one country, they took a decision about Brexit. They know it's a wrong decision, but now they're trying to make a wrong decision right, you know, but it's through populism that you get that kind of thing. So in 10 or 15 years' time, if you have one of those types of populist types of government that may decide to change the Bill of Rights, what is the precedent you're setting that it should not be easy for at such a time to take away some of the most valuable and essential elements of the Bill of Rights? So when you touch the Bill of Rights, I think, invent this process, set it out. So you set out a precedent. It may not be constitutionally binding, but it will be something that you have invented and you put it. I think that's the burden, unfortunately, Chairperson, that you're sitting with. And the aim of that should be legitimacy, not just that the Constitutional Court will say you followed the procedure, it's okay. You know, I think that's the easier part. The more difficult part is how to make it legitimate. So I just wanted to talk about the process as far as that is concerned.
You're now left with 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chair. I unfortunately cannot say everything I want to in 5 minutes, but I'll say what I can. And
sorry, just 1 minute.
Sorry, Madam Chairperson, there doesn't appear to be anybody else ready to present, sir.
Okay. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. The second thing I think that I would advise the committee to do is to more actively communicate what you are doing and what you are not doing. There's a lot of misunderstanding about what Parliament is up to here. I think it will help a lot to clarify that. For one, it will help the economy and job creation, because there are people who are holding back on investments because they think the new law will take their factories away or something of that sort, you know. So I think it's important to say what it's about and what it's not about. So To clarify that, there's just one or two things I'd like to say. The first is that Section 25 of the Constitution in 4B says, for the purposes of this section, property is not limited to land. So in other words, the committee is not considering everything about Section 25. It's only considering a subsection of Section 25, the subsection that deals with land, not with property in general. I think that's important to make it clear, because when you say amendment to the property clause, people think that, for example, you know, intellectual property is under threat, or you know, something of that sort. It's not dealing with property in general. You know that if your daughter has started working and she's now got a motor car and she's paid off half the payments on the motor car, the new law is not going to allow anybody to take the car away. You know, so this is not what it is. This is so and the reason I say that is because the Constitution knows that property goes well beyond land, and that's why it says for the purpose of this section, property is not limited to land. So it's other things. So I think important, the committee is talking about the land issue. That's the first thing that I think it's important to say. So you exclude everything else immediately. I think that I'm not the greatest communicator on earth, but I'm sure your communication people will find a way of just explaining that that's an important thing. The second thing, if I look at the minutes of the National Assembly of the 6th of December, Chairperson, it says that Parliament, I'll just read 31A, which says, amends Section 25 of the Constitution to make explicit that which is implicit in the Constitution. I think those are very important words for people to understand, that the entire notion of property is not being reinvented. It says, make explicit that which is implicit. Chairperson, I think your words are important, that after 25 years, the land question being unresolved, there's a variety of reasons why it's unresolved. We all could talk at length about that matter. And therefore, Parliament is of the view that it will help to make this matter explicit. In other words, don't do something new. It's already there, but make it clear. This is what Parliament is saying. And I think if that is explained to people, it will take a lot of the heat out of what is being attempted here. I really don't believe that it is well understood out there. You know, a lot of us who now and then we flick TV, we see what is being spoken in Parliament and this and that, and we form opinions. And then when you are called to Parliament to make a presentation, then you actually look at the minutes and you say, exactly what is being said? And then, you understand the detail. And I think many people don't understand that detail. I also took the trouble of reading the bill which you referred to, introduced by the Minister of Public Works, expropriation bill number 2019. I read it for the first time when I was called to Parliament. And I found that also very interesting. So I think a lot of these things need to be communicated. So that's what it's about. The last point I'd like to make, because I don't have time, I've got a number of other points, and that it is not true that Section 25 was drafted in order to appease and protect land held illegitimately by white people in this country. It is not true. Under apartheid and in the struggle for freedom in this country, one of the most painful things for African people was that an African person by law could not own property, could not own land, could not even own a matchbox house in the township. It was illegal. And that was one of the most humiliating and painful things for African people in this country. What was even more humiliating was African people were rounded up if they happened to be staying in the wrong place. Their land was taken away, not only without compensation, but even without notice. As late as in the 1980s, you would have a village being surrounded by police vehicles and removal vans in the middle of the night. When people wake up at 5 in the morning, they find they are being packed up and loaded into lorries and being taken away to some other place because that land is now declared white land. So that's the security over tenure and ownership of property was one of the big issues in the struggle, that black people were not allowed to own land, own property, own your own house, your own flat, your own small holding, your own farm as such. It was just not possible. And in amending the property clause, we must bear in mind that we now do have African people owning property, not to the extent that it should have been, but it is still the case. And we do not want, you should not want to do anything which takes us backwards, which reintroduces insecurity for an African farmer who owns a farm, to say that a future government, if it is unhappy for whatever reason, can take your farm away without compensation. You don't want that, because that's what used to happen under apartheid. Under apartheid, African people's land was taken away by force without compensation. And when this constitution was drafted, and when President Mandela was sworn in at the Union Buildings in 1994 as the first democratically elected president, he said, never, never, never again should we have those sorts of practices happen in the Republic of South Africa. And we must make sure that whatever we put in here, it should not be such that you start creating that insecurity that your property can be taken away without compensation. Because I don't think anybody would want that. So that's the big challenge that we have. How do we fulfill one of the big demands of the freedom struggle, and that is to allow African people to become owners of farms, agricultural and other property, and actually advance that and not take that backwards. So that's the other big challenge I think that we're going to be sitting with. Thank you, Chair. I'll stop at that due to the time that you've mentioned.
Thank you very much, Mr. Musa, for those valuable insights indeed in guiding the committee using your own lived experience and having participated in the process and identifying what, in your view, the committee needs to take note of as it undertakes this process. And I think one of the important things that you mentioned was the weightiness of the responsibility that is for this committee as it executes this task given to it by the National Assembly. And also, correctly so, that it may be the first time that the Bill of Rights is being amended. And therefore, what the consequence of that is likely to be for the present and for the future. And also how this process can actually inform future National Assembly locally, but also maybe in the region and internationally in terms of what we are doing. Some of those very weighty matters that you have thrown to this committee, but also how, by default, whatever we do in the execution of this task might create the sense of introducing a tenure insecurity to those who might have benefited out of the dispensation provided for by the final constitution of 1996 on some of these clauses in particular. I would allow the members to raise questions, but I'm sure you would also be ready that when it goes to the next stage of public comment, you would not shy away from coming and making whatever proposals that you have. Any questions for Mr. Musa? Honourable Breitenbach, Smith, Mwabe, for now.
Thank you, sir, for your insight. I'd just like to know if it's possible to, the points that you didn't manage to cover, is it possible to get those in writing?
Yes, we are recording.
I'm sure that
I think it's a nice way of saying maybe if you can put it on paper.
Okay. Maybe I'll do so. I feel
better. Smith?
Thank you, Chair. I want to hook on to your statement that said you know the history of every line in the Constitution, so I'm working from that point. Earlier, you were saying that, and I agree, that what we're dealing with is land and not property in general, and that distinction must be made. But I'm wondering if it is possible to deal with land and not with the water side of it. Because in section or sub H, you then, when I say you, I'm saying the Constitution, then says no provision must inhibit the reform of land and water and related issues. So when we, and I'm asking for your opinion, when we deal with this matter, is it possible to deal, and my understanding is land is the solid, maybe the dagger in the mud. Are we excluding the expropriation of water, or are these things interlinked, intertwined, and one and the same thing in terms of that's the agricultural side. I mean, this is clearly different from the residential side. But when you guys were dealing with this thing, what was your thinking around the land and the water? Were these two separate entities, if I could use that, or was this one? Because I don't think you can deal with the land without dealing with the water, if you're looking at agriculture. So that's just my question. What was the thinking at the time? Thanks, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Mwabe.
Thank you, Chair. Former Minister, one, I will first appreciate your explanation that the perception that seems to suggest that the land question during the negotiations was to appease a certain race at that time. I'm happy that you have clarified that one. But my question is, what prevented you in that particular time to explain explicitly in that Section 25 clause on what we are doing today, expropriation of land without compensation? Why that time you did? Because there were political parties, almost all of them, led by the PC, if I'm not mistaken, who were so strong on the land issue and the return of land. Then in that case, why this was not explicitly stipulated in the Constitution, that we have to deal with it now? That's my only question.
Mbuni?
Thank you very much, Chair. I didn't know whether you left the next round and how much time we have. But certainly, Chair, thanks to the committee for considering the former Minister Musa to be among the people to present. I think all he did on his capacity as a leader and as a cadre of the movement. But we must never stop to say thank you for taking us through to where we are in the present day. I do know that as political formations and students and scholars debate the era about leading to this constitutional debate, and sometimes some are more revolutionary to think that it should have gone insurrectionary route, which all wars end in a negotiation table. Even if there was insurrection, there would have even needed to still be negotiations. Others call it a sellout. I wish they were in the room and they could speak and say, you guys sold out, because that's what this political freedom also say. Chair. Thanks. But I'm just saying, we're discussing constitution, Chair, and if we do not keep capturing its exodus, we will have a problem. People will speak everywhere and think that's a sellout constitution. It's not. And thank you for clarifying the point that even that clause is not a sellout clause, because there are many in them. I want to ask the 1913, Mr. Musa, and your take to it. I could contextualize at length. I see Chair wants us to brief and precise.
Yes,
I could contextualize.
Presenter's time, I think.
Okay, yeah. But the point is, there would have to be a cut-off point somewhere. Some of us believe in evolution, so where would you start? You'd have to start somewhere, and can you theorize and problematize, not problematize, but put the 1913 in context? It did emerge a lot, and other people make nonsense of it. From where I sit, I make sense of it fully.
Order, let's not cast aspersion to whoever, just to ask.
If the 1913, Chair, I'm a politician, I'm politicking around 1913 and around issues that are on the table about it. It's talked about a lot.
Yeah, I'm just saying that what you want him to say,
to comment on 19...
The cut-off date. Yes, you can. Proceed.
Then the next one, Chair, I'd really beg your indulgence, Chair, to be patient with me, because I think these are pertinent issues.
Okay.
We'll be asked when we revise the Constitution, we'll be asked to say something on 19 that I do know for, as a matter of fact. The other one, Chair, is the last one. It's on restitution. Because those sections, 25, talk about land reform as having these three legs, redistribution, tenure security, and restitution. Would you envisage any dispensation where there would be no restitution? And even support my question by saying Judge Madlanga in one landmark, supported by the whole bench of Constitutional Court, really point to the pain of people being forcibly removed in District 6 and whatever, as a cause, as a case, and ask for your opinion, because, again, if we amend the Constitution, in terms of the substantive issues of land, we'll be asked to visit that question and say something about it. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. Honourable Bama, I'm not sure they wanted to ask a question. Okay. Any other question? Mr. Musa.
Thank you, Chairperson. On the first question, as far as water is concerned, the mandate that you have is to deal with the land issue. I think the water question has got a different set of considerations. But the important thing, probably, for the purposes of the work of this committee, is that there is no private ownership of water in the Republic. You cannot own water as private property. You are allocated rights to the use of water by various pieces of legislation. The chairperson once was a minister of agriculture, would know all of these things very well as such. So it is not a matter that I think is an issue for the debate that you have here, because it is not as if the Vaal Dam is owned by, you know, a private person. It's not, it's, water doesn't fall into that category as such. And that all water actually is, people have a right to it. And even if there is a private dam, for example, suppose there's a farm and a farmer, Mr. Smith, builds a dam on the thing. The dam belongs to Mr. Smith, but the water doesn't. He is given a right to collect the water in the dam, and then he's given a right to use the water, and certain quantities of the water would be specified. I'm not saying that the law is always efficiently applied. That's a separate matter altogether. But of course, in the general land reform, land redistribution program, it doesn't help too much if there's a parcel of land is redistributed, but water rights do not go along with it. It wouldn't make much sense because, you know, how most farming activities require some degree of water as such. As far as why did the Constitution not say expropriation without compensation in the first instance? There was, in the first place, an enormous amount of debate about whether the Constitution should say anything about property rights at all. So that was really, the first debate was, should it say anything about property rights? And then the second question was, should property rights be in the Bill of Rights, or should it be somewhere else in the Constitution, the right to own property? Is it a fundamental human right, sitting side by side with the right to freedom of movement, freedom of expression, the right to vote, right to dignity, and those sorts of things? Does it sit? So that was a big debate in itself, and frankly a very important and legitimate debate, because many constitutions in the world, in their Bill of Rights, they say nothing about property. So that was the first debate to be had. And in South Africa, the decision was taken to have a property clause. And that was for two reasons at the time. The one was the reason that I have said already, that ownership of property for African people and security over their property was a very important element of the struggle for freedom. The right to own something. You know, I can't even, I mean, some of you may remember, but the humiliation of the pass laws. I would be walking in the streets of Johannesburg in De Villiers Street with a comrade of mine who happens to be African, and we come across in the street a sudden street roadblock, a pass checking for passes, and my comrade would be thrown at the back of a police van. And the humiliation of that, of no freedom of not even being allowed to be somewhere, the pain of that, that you can't, in your own country, you can't own something, and you can't even be where you want to be. I've seen that happen, you know, I've experienced that on many occasions. I don't think you can overcome that humiliation. So when the question came up, now that you are drafting a constitution, will that ever happen to us again, that our property can be taken away, our houses, our land, Sophia Town can be destroyed, District 6 can be destroyed, communities forced off their land and those sorts of things. So the land, the security of tenure became a very important. So that's the one reason why it was believed that it has a place in the Constitution, and frankly it has a place in the most secure part of the Constitution, in the Bill of Rights. Then there was the other part of it. We were involved in a negotiation at the time with the apartheid enemy, and a big constituency of the apartheid regime were landowners. And so for them, security over especially farming land was a very important issue. So that's the other reason why it came in. Those are the two contending reasons why it had come in. One could have said, well, you could have just ignored the white farmers. But the view was that if you could do something which does nation building, brings everybody on board, because we had this dream of a non-racial society. Maybe we're not there already, but we had this dream of a non-racial society where when a person walks in through that door, the first thing you see would not be the race of the person, you know. It will come one day. We must still have that. So we had the dream of a nation-building thing. Can we do that without undermining the need for land reform and land redistribution? And then the question came in, well, if you have a willing buyer, willing seller thing, a government will never have the money to implement land reform. So we said, make absolutely certain that there's no willing buyer, willing seller thing in the Constitution at all. And the Constitution makes it clear that that is not the consideration that is going to determine how that happens. And so that's how years and years of debate on those 300 words. I'm still, when I look back, I'm still satisfied that the right and correct decision was taken. And I genuinely believe, I would have said if I didn't believe that, I genuinely believe that the lack of land reform is not because of Section 25. It's because of other things. And if I have to say those other things, I will end up attacking my own party in this forum, but that's not what an expert should be doing. But there are things, there are many reasons why it did not happen. Section 25 may have been an obstacle, but it certainly would have been a peripheral obstacle if it was. There are many reasons why this thing did not happen. So I'm satisfied that the right thing was done at the time. And as I've said, as a person, I'm invested emotionally in that Section 25, because you can imagine how many sleepless nights I've, and many others, spent on the thing. But frankly, I don't think we should have any problem with amending it now. It's after 25 years. It's not as if it's being rushed into, or it's being done without thought, or willy-nilly. You know, I don't think anybody should get nervous about taking another look at it. So I'm quite happy with it, and I'm quite happy, Chairperson, that you're suggesting I could come to the public hearings to express my views on that. I'd like to do that, because I think we should involve as many people as we can. Then on the question of the 1913 cut-off, the 1913 Land Act was loomed large in all the decades of the freedom struggle. It was in all the literature, in all the manifestos, in everything, in all the slogans, in everything. You know, that was the big thing. It was the most visible sort of manifestation of theft that we had. And there was also a kind of a neatness to go back to that date, because you could actually trace things quite easily before and after the 1913 Land Act. And that's how that came about. And you know, the African National Congress, for many decades, from its formation onwards, by its own its own pronouncements, had said it's the 1913 Land Act that has brought African people together. Remember, there was no Pan-African organization in South Africa prior to that, and so this is the ninth. So that was a very important element of that. The Constitution does not say that if there was land injustice in 1910, you may not bring about justice about that. You know, it doesn't do that in any sort of way. It puts that as a marker, but it is not in a sense exclusive, I think. So we should not, I think, overrate the day. I heard the President speak in Parliament about the 1913 matter, and I think he spoke about it very eloquently, that that there's no magic in that particular date, and that we need to look at bringing about justice, and it cannot be that if something happened a week before the 1913 Land Act, you know, that therefore. So that's what I would say. You had a question about land redistribution, which I can't now remember. Sorry, Chair.
Maybe he can remind me.
Thanks so much, it's Chair. Thanks, Colonel Valo. It's restitution.
Oh,
the land claims. Like I was referring to Concord ruling that was asserting that certainly there was a case of dispossession and forced removals. Thank you.
I'm not sure what the question. Chair, maybe.
Ask your question again so that you can understand the context in which you raised.
Thank you very much. At the present moment, I also participate. I can't be louder than it. Sorry for that.
It reminds us that we...
Yes, thank you, Chair. Thank you, Chair. No, I was trying to ask Chair for an opinion of our guest and expert, Honorable Musa, on restitution, because the Constitution recognizes these three aspects of land reform, which is tenure security, which is redistribution, and then there's tenure security, and then there's restitution, which is about land claims, the right of people who are forcibly removed to be able to get equitable redress or their land back where practical. At the present moment, I'm sitting every week in that committee. At the present moment, there seems to be arguments that are dismissing it out of hand, that this question of restitution is nonsense, so to put it. I'm summarizing what I experience every week, every time. So I'm asking your opinion on the issue about land claims as a principle. I don't mind the modalities and the institutional arrangements. Thank you, Chair. I don't know if I've done justice to the question.
Yeah, the Chairperson, the issue of land claims and land restitution and the mechanisms that have been placed around that with the Land Claims Commissioner, the Provincial Land Claims Commissioners, the Land Claims Court, and all of the institutional arrangements about it and the legislation that supports that is an absolutely fundamental part of the national program to bring about land reform. It's not directly linked to the actual amendments that you are going to make, but as a program it's absolutely important, and it cannot be faulted. The big problem that we have is that the institutions responsible for implementing the programs have a dismal record in doing so, unfortunately, and that is the problem that we have. I don't think anybody's been able to come up with a better institutional and legal framework within which we can do that. Where a person or a group of persons are able to say, this was our land, it was taken away on such and such a date, and we want it back. And through administrative inefficiencies or any other reason, not a lack of finance, by the way, because those institutions have never been underfunded. In every budget, they've been adequately funded, and as you know, those institutions have actually never spent all their money every year. And that includes the administrations, by the way, I was part of. It's not just a recent thing as such. So I think those are institutions that have to be made to work. It was thought of up very, very carefully, and globally I think they're still recognized as being good institutions. And we will still need them, by the way. Whatever the amendment says here, those are the institutions that are going to be needed in order to bring about land, whether we amend Section 25, not amend it slightly, amend it more, we'll still need those same institutions and the same budgets to do what we're doing. And Parliament, I don't think, Chairperson, it's really under the scope of this committee, but Parliament needs to put much more energetic focus on those institutions and get them to work properly. There's been allegations of corruption around those institutions. There's been all of those sorts of things, and I think we would be well advised to put as much energy into fixing those institutions as we have done on the question of amendment to Section 25. It's taken up a lot of energy. All these public hearings all around the country and lots of debates and lots of, which is all good. I like all these things. But we're not putting as much energy actually on getting things done. And when I asked somebody, I'm going to address the committee, what should I say? She said, tell the committee that while this process of amendment is going on, don't take the focus off what actually needs to be done, and that is land reform. Speed up the land reform at the same time. Show the commitment that's there. So if you have a way of influencing the committees in Parliament that are meant to do that, it would be, I think, advisable, because it would give you the political scope to do this, the work that you have to do, the constitutional work, in peace, I think, if that work is happening properly. It will give you that. But if that is seen to be stalled, it's not happening, then you're working in a pressure cooker and in a difficult political environment which puts undue pressure on you to take a decision maybe a bit quicker than you're actually ready to take. That's all I'd like to say. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Musa, for your responses and advice. Maybe Honorable Mbuni, on the matter that you just raised, if you go back to the interim constitution of 1993, specifically clause 121, provides for restitution of land rights. On subsection 1 of that clause, it actually indicates that a legislation in respect of that clause on restitution of land rights must be promulgated. And that's where actually 1913 is put explicitly as the cutoff date, as Mr. Musa was saying, as the reference from where you could actually start to deal with other matters. But what might be important for the other committee you serve on, arising out of that, relates to the Expropriation Act of 1975, because there's an explicit reference made in that section of how land that were expropriated using Section 1975 1975 Expropriation of Land Rights Act, claims that fall within that when that legislation was dealt with should be provided. So you can just go back, maybe your committee can go back to those three clauses, because even in respect of the commission, the specific things that the interim constitution, which the principle says, on 123, it deals with the court orders which relate to the land claims court and its orders, how those would be treated. And maybe as the committee, both of public works and land, look at the Expropriation Act, would have to also revisit that one back so that you don't have to delay certain sections. Thank you very much and welcome, Judge Sachs, and we must apologize that there was a little bit of a issue with the transport and that's why we're not here on time. Ruth, I'm not sure whether you would mind if we go back, because Jack Sachs was the one coming after Vali and you were coming after him. And now that he's here, can I give you the floor? Thank you.
I'm smiling now because I've suffered from a disease called separation of powers for 20-something years, and I'm sitting next to my old friend and comrade and colleague, Vali Musa, in Parliament. So the separate powers are now coming together, the judiciary, Parliament, and the executive. But also I feel so envious. We worked so hard for our law degrees, we wrote so much, and here is this person who's a mathematician, and he puts things so clearly and so crisply. And we had other people, Colin Eglin, who was a land surveyor, Praveen Gordon, not lawyers. And somehow they captured the constitutional issues in ways that we lawyers often couldn't do. But I'm here to lead a little bit of a fight back on behalf of some judicial thinking. I'm not sure if you'd like me to make a statement or just answer your questions.
You can actually present in the manner that you feel best that it would assist the committee in doing so. We gave a general question to all of you as a guide, and I think knowing what we're trying to address, you can make your statement because we are looking at what would assist the committee better. Mr. Musa also, having given him that question, he actually took an approach where he took us back into the constitution-making process and what, in his view, are matters that we should consider as we do so as a committee, more in-depth on process as well, but also appreciating what are certain principles that we needed to address. So I'm saying, in your presentation, give us the best that we could, which will assist this team as it does its work.
Yes, well, there are four points that I'd like to raise in response to the questions that were raised in the documentation sent to me. The first deals with the amendment as such. The second with the legislative program that will be necessary to give meaning and substance so that you don't end up with simply a change in the Constitution and there's no direction in terms of follow-through. The third is, I'm going to now call it the Albie Sachs proposal, but I hope it doesn't remain the Albie Sachs proposal, the need to reconfigure and look at land law generally, property law generally, in the context and specific conditions of South Africa. And the last is the role of the courts, an issue that's been raised, and there's clearly a reluctance to allow matters to become tangled up in the courts, dragging on forever, frustrating land reform. But I think it is important to highlight, as I propose to do, that there has to be an ultimate voice of the court to make sure that it's not the administration deciding itself who's to get what under what conditions. So the first, in terms of the amendment, when we drafted the constitution, we were clear it's an entrenched constitution, it's not easily amended. We wanted it to be there for fair weather and bad weather, not just people coming into office and saying, oh no, no, we don't want to be bound by it. So there are fairly strict procedures laid down, and it's something that should not be rushed, and the sobriety, if you like, the seriousness is built into the structure of the processes to be followed. So I was a little alarmed at seeing some mention in the document sent to me that the amendment has to be adopted by the present parliament, and that would seem to me to be a very anti-amendment process, simply to meet a target date like that. And it's difficult to see how it could even feasibly be done at all with the requisite times and process to be followed. But generally speaking, there are two ways you could have a very laconic amendment. Just change one or two words in the text and leave it at that. Or you can say, this is a moment in South African history, a significant moment, a moment of reflection, a moment that's very significant in the whole process of true nation building. So we want the amendment to have a certain resonance. The amendment as such then can have a preamble which sets out why the amendment is necessary. The preamble doesn't go into the Constitution, but it can be an important guide in terms of for future generations, for the courts, as to what the purpose of the amendment is and what its meaning is in terms of the evolution of the country. The danger with having an expansive amendment is then people fight over every word in the amendment, in the preamble. But the advantage is if you get a preamble that follows something along the lines of, I think it's the concluding paragraph of the opening section that summarizes why we need the change, I think that would be very helpful and very useful. It gets that sort of balance between the need for overcoming this huge historical injustice, massive injustice, with continuing consequences in the country, but in a context which is productive, which leads to more energies of the people being involved with the land, and not simply some kind of formal process of transferring title from one section to another section. That I think, so I would personally favor the amending law having a preamble that captures some of the different considerations that you've already captured in terms of setting up this wrap-up session. On the other hand, you might say, we don't want to be fighting over the terms of the preamble. It's difficult enough to agree on what technical words should go into the Section 25. But I personally, LB, would favor a preamble. It's helpful for the courts. It's helpful for establishing the tone, the context, the significance of the provision. And I think it's dignified because this is a great moment in South African history. We are seizing that nettle, and it's painful and it's difficult. And it's not cost-free. Nothing is cost-free if it's really significant. It's disruptive. On the other hand, it has to be disruptive. That's why the amendment is brought in. The status quo is not satisfactory. On the other hand, disruptive doesn't mean you end up with disruption. The disruption has to produce positive consequences. I've been looking at the text, and one can see various different points of intervention. where the words could be introduced. I wouldn't like to offer anything of my own bat, but if at some stage you have alternative, do you do it, add it onto Section 25(8), do you add it onto the expropriation section, I'd be very happy to offer for what it's worth, my own views on what would be the neatest, the tidiest, and the most coherent. You want coherence, technical transform, new words to be put in. I think it's got to be clearly understood that simply to add some words that make it very clear that expropriation without compensation is constitutionally permissible, and just to leave it at that would be very inadequate. Parliament would have a function at least to develop, it could be a program, a strategy, a way forward in terms of implementation of significant land reform. I think the high-level report provides extraordinarily rich information, so you're not starting from scratch, you don't have to do that basic research, but that information about the failures. I would like to add, however, I still remember the early days, 96, 97, when people were getting their land back. It wasn't a dismal failure. I think something like, is it 65, 70,000 land claims were processed. People either got their land back or in many cases got alternative compensation. It was very, very meaningful. So it's not as though nothing resulted from that program of restitution. And I do remember now speaking with my memory as one of the drafters, when we chose 1913, we were actually thinking we're going quite far back, because the idea of restitution, not land reform, but restitution, which meant specific land going back to specific owners, arose out of the resistance to forced removals in the 70s, the 80s, which were very vivid. And many people suffered as a result of that, and many of the members of Parliament had been involved themselves in those campaigns. So the idea was that they should be able to get their land back, and it would be District 6, it would be Cato Manor, it would be the so-called black spots where African communities were moved, and they got their land back, and there was jubilation. So I think we must also respect and build on the positive achievements. Otherwise you feel everything is a failure, we're not up to it, without in any way diminishing the failures that came afterwards and the present sense of crisis that things just aren't moving, that it just isn't working. In any event, I feel that the committee, in any report it makes, I would suggest, underlines the importance of some kind of legislative program, and whether it requires one comprehensive land restitution and reform law or whether the existing laws can be amended, I don't know. These are, if you like, parliamentary strategic issues, but they have a certain principle underlying it. And one of the problems that was pointed out by the High Level Commission is different sectors are working in their different areas. There's been a lack of coherence. The third point that I want to make is about the need in South Africa to create what I would call a South African property law regime. If you look at property law throughout the world, I might be wrong, but in most countries, it's either based on the original Roman law concepts of property and ownership, which then went through the civil law systems, and the countries that were colonized or dominated by European countries adopted land law programs based on the civil law, And our Roman law background has a similar origin. And then it was influenced by developments in some countries, Germany. I think the German system was then transferred to many countries in Asia, Middle East. And then other countries colonized by the British took over the British land law. So the United States has got originally British-type land law, Australia, New Zealand, India, probably a combination of different things of that kind. And we were taught about the virtues of the Roman law system as being much clearer, neater, more coherent, and adapted to the needs of commerce and society as it was evolving in Europe and then in South Africa afterwards. So we have things like land ownership, powerful property, then you can have a usufruct, it's called. It's a life interest in the land and the benefits of the land that comes from the Roman law. We have rights of way. In England they call easements. We call them servitudes. We have the most frequent thing is tenancies. And then it all goes back originally to Roman law, but it's been very much all of these affected by statutes. So there's rent control, landlords controlled, and so on. But all these basic concepts, title and the different interests in land less than full title, are based on a system like that. Now, I can remember we learnt a long, long time ago when I was at UCT Law School, everybody who owned land owned all the structures on the land. That's the structure if it was really built in. So the buildings all belonged to the owner, and you couldn't separate ownership of land from ownership of structures. Now, that became very inconvenient for capitalists. I'm using capitalists in a technical economic sense now. I'm not saying the bloody capitalists or the white monopoly capitalists. I'm just saying the people who wanted to make more money to put up their blocks of flats. So they introduced the concept of sectional title, which meant you can own your own flat, even though you don't own the land. Now that went against almost 2,000 years of Roman law. It was like a violation of everything we'd been taught. But now we take sectional title for granted, and you have all sorts of regulations, statutes dealing with sectional title. And what's come through to me is just as sectional title had to be introduced to reconceive the nature of ownership, we need to find much more flexible and appropriate and appropriately balanced concepts of land ownership and use in South Africa. Let me give you some examples. The question of ownership of the communal land, the area of the Inkanyama Trust as well, which has its own specificities. Under the present law, the question is asked, who owns the land? Is it the traditional leader, able then to get rent, that's using the analogy of renting, or is it the people on the ground? If the people feel they own the land, then I've been learning they want that sense of security that legal title gives you. They want to feel they can't just be moved out. They want to feel if the land is needed for mining, then they must get compensation, like anybody else, like any other owner. They want that feel, you know, it's so much, it's no accident that the marvelous book, Flaike's book, starts off with we are wanderers in our own land. That sense of we don't have a connection with the land. There's nowhere, he mentions the case of even the people burying their child who died of hunger. They couldn't even find a spot of land to bury that child. They had to meet secretly at night. It's so moving, one wants to cry when you think of it. And that was 1916, I think, or 1912 when he was writing. And yet that sense of insecurity is still so strong. So people want title. On the other hand, I'm being told this whole idea of title, that you can put a fence up around a piece of land, it's yours, is very alien to African culture and tradition. That somehow the land has a meaning of belonging to everybody, being in trust for everybody. It actually fits in very well with contemporary environmental thinking. The stewardship of land is very, very strong in African culture. And that's against the idea of title means I've got my title deed, I'm the owner, I can do what I damn well like, I have to pay taxes on it, but it's mine. It's somehow hostile. So how do you balance the interests then? And also title has the advantage of if you want to raise money, you can give the land as collateral. So it's important for the development. It provides security. But the security can turn to insecurity if you can't pay. The bank seizes the land and suddenly that sense of the land belonging to the community is lost. And the selfishness of the investor somehow is seen as hostile to the interests of the community. So the problem arises partly that we are trying to fit in the different interests involved into the boxes provided by the old Roman Dutch law as influenced by statute in South Africa. And I think we've got to start thinking of new boxes. It's not a new box, it's new boxes. But I give you that one example. The other example could be in terms of transferring interests in land. The 50-50 thing has been tried. The one example that's been highly publicized hasn't been very successful. But maybe we should be thinking not in terms of transferring shareholding as such, but in terms of allowing for interest, shared interest in the same piece of land in a way that maybe our present common law, neither the Roman Dutch common law nor the African common law would allow for. And we might even need some new language for that. But I could envisage, for example, a farm in, say, the center of the country, not to identify any province. The two possible ways of transferring from white ownership based historically on conquest to black ownership that have been mentioned is you take the land away from the white owners, you give the title to black owners. Might be the people on the farm, it might be others, that's one. Or the other example has been given, the state becomes the owner of all land and then leases it out in a different way. I would like to envisage creating mechanisms that would allow people who were called tenants before, the farm workers, have a long historic connection with that land. They've been there for generations. It's not only the ancestors are invested there, they've invested their sweat, they've plowed, they've reaped, they've looked after the cattle, they've milked the cows, they've chased the hens and fed the hens and so on. They have a real strong connection. If that historic, cultural and sweat connection with that land gets a form of recognition, and it could be incremental degrees of ownership. It could be that the white farm owner has a special connection with the farmhouse where he grew up, has very emotional connections and meaning for him. That would be important for him. It might be that that white owner would want to have his horses. I must tell you, by the way, I know nothing about land and nothing about farming. I grew up by the beach.
If you come up with a beach question, I can tell you. But farming, anything that grows, that moves, that makes a moving sound, I'm completely out of my depth. But I'm just trying to imagine now the coming up with some form of mixed ownership that progressively gets stronger for the people with a strong connection and progressively gets less for the people, if you like, of the older white generation. It has the advantage of enabling the skills in terms of transporting, investing, and so on, that by and large the whites have, to remain there for some time while new people are being trained. It has the advantage of the people with the long historic connection with that actual land remaining there and feeling now they're not just die Plaaswerkers, they're not just the workers, they become the owners. But it's a progressive thing, so that there is progressive increase. It's not 50-50 to begin with. It might be much less, and then over the years it's a form, if you like, of whether or not the white owner is compensated or how much the white owner is compensated, whether compensation comes out of the proceeds. You know, these are things that could be worked on. But to my mind, this would require recalibrating, more than recalibrating, reconceiving the nature of rights, legally protected rights in land law in relation to what we have at the moment. And it's not something that you just do, you know, you wake up in the morning and you have a shower and I've got a brilliant brainwave, let's do this. It would require a lot of thought. I can think of people like my former colleague Johan van der Westhuizen, who actually was an expert on Roman Dutch law. He was unusual. Some of us are experts on constitutional law, and we rather turned our backs on Roman Dutch law as almost being an impediment to the new kind of thinking we want. But he made that combination very, very well, and he was involved in quite extensively in the drafting of the 1996 Constitution. And maybe a team could be set up, but it would have to work quite quickly. To send it to the Law Reform Commission, they take 3, 4, 5, 10 years sometimes, particularly when it's difficult. I think the pace would be all wrong. This is something that should be built in to the very nature of the legislative programs that you're thinking of. The last point that I wish to make, some statement was made recently to the effect that I think it's this committee, is keen to avoid the courts from playing too big a role in the land reform process. And I can understand completely why that's so. That the courts are seen as mechanisms for delaying. You lose what you want and then you take it on appeal and goes on appeal and the farm is just waiting there for years and no decision's taken. And I think that's a very important consideration, an absolutely valid one. But it would be very dangerous to remove the courts from having some ultimate supervision. And I'm going to say this now because I'm going to speak about the court at a time when I was not on it. I'm not bragging about Alf's period on the courts, but I think everybody in South Africa who's a Democrat and who is proud of this country would say our judiciary has played an astonishingly significant role in maintaining certain core principles of integrity, certain core values that lie at the very heart of our Constitution, the values we were fighting for. And it's not an accident. We built that in. Some people say in 1990, when we were thinking about the Constitution, we had in mind that it's a Constitution for everybody like Nelson Mandela. Impeccable conduct. That's not true. The inaugural lecture I gave at the University of Cape Town in 1991 was called Perfectibility and Corruptibility. And I quoted the Ghanaian writer who said, the beautiful ones are not yet born. And a Zimbabwean had said the same. And we'd lived all over the African continent, we'd lived in other continents, and we'd seen how people who'd fought heroically for freedom had often gone on to abuse their positions in power. We'd seen it firsthand. We'd seen inside our own organization that people had abused their power. So perfectibility, aiming for that, but guarding against corruptibility. And that was our vision at the time when we created the Constitution, to guard against corruptibility. And we built in, ultimately, the Chapter 9 institutions. We are having elections coming up quite soon. It's not going to be like Nigeria. Who really won in Nigeria? It's not going to be like the Congo. It's not even going to be like the United States, where there's so much voter suppression and so on. We have a judiciary that has been doing its work. Sometimes people in Parliament feel it's been a little bit too intrusive, and that's a good argument to have in terms of some of the details. But basically, in holding the line, it's been there. And what we'd seen in other countries, if the executive has the power to decide who gets the land, the temptations for the land to go to the families of the executive, to their friends, to their sons-in-law, to the people who contribute to the party becomes enormous. There has to be an external control. And the Constitutional Court was set up initially precisely to prevent Parliament from itself saying, we have complied with the 34 principles agreed to in advance. So that ultimate bulwark of an independent judiciary, to me, is crucial. The problem then is to make sure that the courts don't become too intrusive, that they don't become mechanisms for delaying everything, mechanisms for allowing the rich and the powerful to tie up very important social transformation processes in the courts. But the answer is not to exclude the courts. And at last, I don't want to issue a warning to Parliament, but let me put it as a signal. We had a case where the late Ismail Mohammed in the Constitutional Court said there are some themes in the Constitution that can't be changed even by 100% majority, because then you're not amending the Constitution, you are undermining the Constitution. And that was taken from an experience in India where Indira Gandhi took very strong executive powers to detain people, and Parliament passed a law with the requisite majorities to amend the Constitution, saying that the courts would be excluded from reviewing those detentions. And the Indian Supreme Court said that's not amending the Constitution, that's destroying constitutionalism. Constitutionalism presupposes that there's somebody outside of the body that's exercising the powers that can review whether or not the Constitution has been complied with. So that theme of fundamental features is now one that's been picked up by courts in other countries. In Colombia, a very brilliant constitutional court there, when the president Uribe got a measure passed by Parliament with the requisite majorities to allow him to stand for an extra term, the court struck that down and said only a body similar to the body that had originally composed the Constitution would have the authority to do that. This is simply saying that, reinforcing the importance of having an independent body. And I think in our case, in some countries, you have very corrupt judiciaries whom you can't depend on and rely on. I think in our country, our judiciary has been doing its work very well. So you wouldn't want to have a constitutional crisis if you excluded the judiciary, and that itself was taken to the judiciary to decide whether that exclusion is now amending a fundamental feature of the Constitution and is unconstitutional. We've already once declared the Constitution to be unconstitutional. I think Bally Moosa remembers very well sitting in the court up in Johannesburg, and his jaw was dropping and dropping when we mentioned 9 different points that didn't comply with the original principles. It went back to Parliament. The corrections were made. We now have the most wonderful constitution. I think the court would do its job in future just as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Judge Al-Fisak, for the incisive input and advice on, but also sharing your reflections on what are some matters that may correctly arising out of this process that might actually require another process of addressing some of the mischief and the problems that we are having in respect of the land matters. I would open for questions of clarity. Anna Smith?
Just one question, Chair. Not even a question, a comment. And Judge Jack, thanks for the contribution. You know, our mandate from Parliament was make explicit that expropriation without compensation is legal. That's our mandate. In your input, you indicated that to make it explicit, just that on its own, would be highly inadequate, if I understood you correctly. If you just put those words, in other words, if you just put words to make it explicit, it would be inadequate, and that we would need more. As things stand now, there's an expropriation bill that will probably be an act, hopefully, at some point, that is going to deal with the how. My understanding is we're saying make it legitimate, but the how part would come through legislation. So, in my mind, I'm very clear that the constitutional amendment, is not the be-all and end-all of it. It's just saying that this must be, the how part comes through the accompanying legislation. So my question is, would that allay your fears of this not being adequate? The second point, and I think both you and Vali raised it, and Mr. Moosa raised it. Sorry, I thought I was still in lens. Mr. Moosa raised it. You know, this thing of nation building, and I concur 100% with it. But I can tell you that when we were on the road, it became very, very apparent that we have two extremes. There are those that are saying we can't wait anymore. This thing of nation building and appeasing the other side just is not on. We want it and we want it now. That was the one extreme. Then we had the other extreme that was saying, look, but guys, you can't do this because it's my whole life. In fact, I recall somebody saying, when I go to my farm, it's my pension, it's my job, and it's my security. That's how the other side saw it. So, how do we do this thing that we are expected to do, taking into consideration the disruption that you're talking about, or the disruptiveness? How do we do this thing and maintain the nation-building aspect of it? Because for me, it's almost impossible to reconcile these two things now without the one side feeling that, but I'm bending over too far, or I've bent over too far for too long. Just a comment. Is it possible?
Another comment or question before I allow the judge? Maybe from the chair, there's a point you made, Judge, and I wasn't sure whether you were saying it must preface the section that is being amended on the Bill of Rights, or specifically on that section where you say we might need a preamble of sorts. Would that be a preamble in Section 25, or were you considering that preamble in the section that deals with the Bill of Rights generally? And if you can comment on that one. You also raised, and I'm trying to understand you well, that one of the challenges that we face in South Africa is that you still have multiple tenure system where you've got freehold rights on one hand and then you have got customary rights on the other, even though those customary rights, the state is still a custodian, particularly with the remaining 13% in South Africa's rural areas. That may be one of the issues which may not be for the constitution-making process, but for the general law of application in the either land law or whatever, would be to also find a way of how you manage these tensions or find a codification that would enable an interpretation of that informal right, if one were to call it. And as you said, that also the relationship of the land and how it is understood, particularly in the African context. There's a scholar, I think, in West Africa and East Africa. East Africa, it would be Okoto Ogendo from Kenya, who was dealing with the spiritual nature of understanding the land rights from an African context, that is not just only about those who are living, but also the relationship of the land to the dead and those who are about to come. And how do you put that in law? So, and I think you were raising that issue for us to say, but at the same time, as societies evolve, there has been a cry, and I know from the women's movement, even the wives of Amakhosi in particular in the Eastern Cape, were raising a very interesting issue about the rights, you know, for the girl child, particularly when it comes to inheritance and access to land, to say, why is it that the girl's relationship to land is bound to the prospective marriage to somebody else? Why can't that girl child, in her own right in the family, be allotted land without an appendage of her to being married or her coming back from marriage? So I'm just saying that you've raised those tensions to say maybe the long-term issues, and maybe Ruth Hall's panel that might have to deal with in the long term. How do you deal with those tensions in the South African's jurisprudence, in the land law, for instance? Maybe there's another one who has been inspired from the team to make some comments. If not, I will hand over back to Judge.
Yes. The change to the Constitution, the amendment, to very explicitly and clearly authorize expropriation without compensation is enormously important in itself. So I'm not saying that's inadequate. It's an historic moment, and it has enormous symbolical meaning and significance. But if it just stands there, and there's no follow-through with meaningful and sustainable transformation of tenure on land, then people will feel doubly defeated. So we've changed the Constitution, we've got the possibilities, and nothing's happening. Or if what's happening is it's still people benefiting their pals, there'll be a powerful reaction. That's the part. It would be insufficient, I think, is a better word than inadequate. In terms of purely technical presentation, you can have a very laconic, very neat, very simple amendment to the Constitution. So I think it's called the Amendment to the Constitution Act, such and such of this year. One, the Constitution shall be amended by substituting these words or adding those words, and it goes in, full stop. Or you can dress it up a little bit. This is not just a technical change. This is not just a border change. The border changes are very important for people living there, but they don't affect the nation. This affects the nation. So you can give it a certain dramatic quality, if you like, in the very language of the law, not changing the Bill of Rights. It's not a preamble to the Bill of Rights. It's a preamble to the amending law. And that preamble says, whereas it's become clear that da-da-da-da, whereas the needed da-da-da-da, whereas this certain objectives of increasing production, increasing, then maybe that vision of African family farming becoming something important, the initiatives coming in, all that's put into the preamble to the amending act, because you can't amend the Bill of Rights as such. There's a preamble to the whole constitution. That'd become very messy, and you don't really want to touch. It's almost poetic. It's balanced. It's calibrated. So that would be a chance then for Parliament to allow a certain level of it's both emotion, strong emotion, and consensus seeking to be incorporated in the language to the amending act. The how, clearly this committee shouldn't attempt even to prescribe how the implementation should take place, but the committee can say that in supporting the following technical amendments to the Constitution and maybe a preamble as follows, this committee points out to the public, to Parliament, that this is simply an important step, and unless something further is done to deal with the legislation, it's just a guide to the next phase, a reminder in relation to the next phase. I don't want to say irresponsible, that's quite strong. It would be more responsible if you actually spelled that out for anybody reading your report. It doesn't have to be very long, just one strong paragraph could be enough. In terms of nation building, we built a nation when it seemed impossible, after hundreds of years of oppression, of visible apartheid, leaders locked up, people tortured to death, assassinated. How could we get a united South Africa? And we got it, and we've got this parliament, and I'm looking around now. People call it a miracle. It wasn't a miracle. It was hard thought, it was intelligence, at some stage rally mass action played a role, there were all sorts of different factors, but in the end we got it. And so I think the first step towards true nation building is to acknowledge the tensions, not to try and say they're not there. And you picked them up when you traveled around. And I think you've got to acknowledge them not simply as facts, you've got to acknowledge it from the heart of people. It's got an emotional meaning. And you've got to see human beings grappling. And you've got to try and find the mechanisms for giving realistic hope to everybody involved in the project. So when I came up with this example of mixed forms of tenure in the same piece of property, different from the current, you're either the owner or you're a lessee, or you've got a servitude, or you've got a usufruct, to come up with new modalities of shared ownership of the same piece of land, regulated by law, that doesn't say it's holus bolus. Monday you're the owner, Tuesday you've got nothing, and you had very little before, now you've got everything. It's to have this idea of mobile, evolving, developing forms of relationship to the same piece of land. Process also becomes very important. Attempting to get that white farmer who said, this is my pension, this is my life, this is my home. It's not just a piece of property that I own. It must be part of the process of saying to that farmer, we understand where you come from. But think of the people working on the farm, what they've been through, what it means to them. How can we get some kind of reconciliation? My sense is there isn't one side size fits all. That the nature of the land, the nature of the occupation, the nature of the production even can vary. And I'm not just speaking about the commonly owned land and the rest of privately owned land. Even the privately owned land, the characteristics will vary quite extensively. But at least to begin that idea of as much discourse on the ground as possible, but directed towards changing the interest in land in an irreversible way that is directed towards establishing a productive, basically African family farming on the land. Some of that has to be built in, but in a way that is not totally conflictual, that is not humiliating, that's not saying we're in power now, go to hell. You know, that's the way the colonialists behaved, in effect. And I always think of Oliver Tambo in circumstances like this. We don't take our morality from the people who robbed the people of their land. We don't say they did it to us, now we do it to them. We've got to have a new way of thinking that we are human beings, we want to live together in one country, we want to find successful and meaningful transformations and change that can actually bring us closer together. And maybe that's one of the paradoxes about working on the land. One hears all the time of often there are very close bonds of daily work and connection and sweat between the white owners and the farm workers. But the minute it becomes to questions of ownership and who's the boss, that's where the division comes in. But if those actual close bonds can be developed into new forms of connection with that land, I think that could be actually very powerfully nation building. And then bodies like the more forward-looking white farmers in the organizations and so on could play a very positive role in that. They can't control the process, but they can contribute to those processes. So when the multiple tenure systems then, I think when this new forms and categories of land tenure and utilization and benefit are worked out, that would be a marvelous opportunity to introduce, first of all, the non-sexist vision of our constitution, to spell it out. And it's a known fact that in many parts of the country, it's the women who do most of the agricultural work, and it's certainly in the communal areas. And their connection with the land is very insecure. It's insecure under the Roman Dutch law that's been inherited in terms of title, because they don't have registered title. And it's insecure in terms of the way the ossified old interpretations of customary law have been developed, which the Constitutional Court has overturned by saying customary law is living customary law. So these principles of living customary law could be built into the new tenure concepts that could be developed. And at the same time, the environmental theme could be built in. Environmental preservation of our earth is something I find is very strong in African culture, that respect for the soil, for the rivers, for the rocks, for living things. And it's a huge resource for that stewardship of land that I think would strengthen more justice on land in terms of one of the factors to be built in. Maybe it could be, I don't know technically, there could be a code, a point of reference, I don't know. It's quite drastic in terms of recalibrating technical laws of leasehold and usufruct and servitude and so on that lawyers grow up with. But it's not it's not out of touch with reality, with lived reality. It's not in that sense a revolution. It would be making the law correspond better to the lived reality in a much fairer and more just way and more productive way. So I see it having a very big, big potential. And it's not just the long term. To my mind, this has to be built into the land reform program. It's going to affect process. So it's not just for one day being able to achieve that. It should be built into the very mechanisms of land reform.
Thank you very much. Somebody may be trying to reach us here. And thank you once again, Judge Albisax, for your input as well as your responses. And I'm sure when we round up, as we listen, we can hear the similarities on what are the fundamental issues that we need to retain as we deal with this process. One of those being the process. That we need to be mindful that this is really not just an easy amendment that we are taking into consideration. The nature of the resource we are dealing with, the nature of the right that we are dealing with in terms of the Bill of Rights. So the process will also have to be important, and how we take the citizenry around, because this may be another chance for South Africa to have a dialogue amongst its people in looking at this very important infinite resource, the land. The other issue that is coming through, the legitimacy of the outcome of the process, given that you would want the broad consensus in society on what the outcome of this process will mean for everybody. And I think there's some introduction of new areas that you are saying the committee must consider, that it can actually input by giving an agenda of what would need to happen in other spheres, whether in terms of government, whether in terms of the other legislation, which might require another process of amending elsewhere. And I'm really happy that the other expert who will present to us was part of the high-level panel, which did tremendous work in terms of research, though it was broader in a sense looking at the legislation that was made, but there was a substantive section on the issue of land reform, the experience of citizens about how it has affected them, you know, as well as the institutional making. But what is also interesting is that the same expert is also a member of the presidential panel that, you know, is also looking at the land, and I'm sure she's heard from some of your presentations and the views that are coming from people you have interacted with before coming here, and also one of the members of the committee have just said that whatever we're doing here does not diminish what is already provided for in the Constitution that must happen. So where there is a dysfunctionality in our system on how we deliver land reform in terms of what is agreed to, those must be sorted out. They mustn't wait for this process. I would ask us to have a 5 minutes comfort break. We can take the tea, continue to drinking it inside. The reason I'm giving you only 5 minutes comfort break is because some members have to leave because of their flights, but it would be nice for them to hear Ruth's presentation. So we can have a 5 minutes comfort break, take our tea from outside, come in and proceed with the work. Thank you very much.